today, as I say, we are looking again at the Middle East region. Again, we've set a slightly strange title for this discussion. The battle against IS in Iraq and Syria, what happens next? So I've got four little crystal balls here. We're going to be able to fill us in on that. I will introduce the speakers now. You've all got their biographies. Very briefly, on my immediate right, I've got Dr. Afzal Ashraf, who was a senior officer in the Royal Air Force. He was appointed to the multinational force in Baghdad, where he contributed to political, military and economic strategy, working at times directly for the US ambassador and the general commanding. He became a research fellow at St Andrews University, Centre for the Study of Terrorism and Political Violence. He is well qualified to talk to us today on this subject. I will be asking him to speak first. After him, I'm going to call on Dr. Riyad Mansour, who is an Academy Fellow at the Middle East and North Africa Programme at Chatham House. And prior to that, he was an Ariane Fellow at the Carnegie Middle East Centre, where he examined, in particular, Iraq, Iran and Kurdish affairs. Again, I think we will hear some very interesting comments from him. I'll then call third on Dr. Julian Lewis, MP, who is the Chairman of the House of Commons Defence Committee. He's been a Conservative MP since 1997, and he served for a time with me on the Intelligence and Security Committee. And again, he will have some very firm views that I'm looking forward to hearing. And finally, I'll call on, immediately on my left, on Jonathan Paris, who's a London-based Middle East analyst. He was, before he came to this country, Middle East Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations in New York. He's currently Senior Advisor with the Chertoff Group, an Associate Fellow at the International Centre for the Study of Radicalisation at King's College. And I will ask him to address us last. But first, I'm going to call upon Dr. Afzal Ashraf.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Our chairman has made it abundantly clear to me that 8 minutes is all I have to tell you what's going to happen next year in probably the most complex region and most contracted conflict that we've seen for a long time. So I'm going to start my stopwatch and give you all the answers in those precious 8 minutes. What we've seen recently is a huge amount of unprecedented success in Mosul, in Iraq. It's by success, I mean now. Whether that success is sustained will depend on a number of things, but particularly it will depend on how that success is reinforced militarily. The point about most insurgencies, but particularly about modern terrorist-based insurgencies, is that they are brilliant at adapting to change, whereas most conventional forces are slow. And so that success has to be reinforced to prevent Daesh from returning to a cellular terrorist organization in the cities, particularly in the Al Anbar province. And so the speed at which that success is reinforced is critical to the future. One of the other things that will determine how things pan out is how the various contributors to this conflict in Iraq are rewarded politically. For example, we have, of course, the Iraqi army, but ably assisted by the Iranians, the US to some degree, but certainly we have the involvement of Shia militias, the Peshmerga, and Turkey is on the scene too. How those political issues are resolved will determine the difference between Daesh being deprived of the oxygen of grievances upon which it thrives or not. Moving on to Syria, an early attack and recapture of Raqqa will complete the symbolic damage to Daesh. We'll go a very long way to destroying the myth of this Islamic state that they've created. So it does mean that Raqqa should be retaken, hopefully successfully, fairly soon to have that impact. If we don't, as I've said, these organisations, and I've been looking at their ideological narratives, since 1998 with Al-Qaeda, they are brilliant at reinventing the narrative, and they will do that very effectively and still continue to inspire their support. The war in Syria is primarily not about Daesh. It is, in my assessment, primarily about the removal or the removal or survival of the Assad regime. And as long as we have this duality of strategy, then we will continue to have problems in terms of complexity, in terms of lack of resolution. So far, as far as the Western-backed coalition appears to be concerned, the main effort is in supporting the mythical 70,000 moderates that we are told will get rid of Mr. Assad and his murderous regime and bring peace to the region. The point is that these 70,000 rebels have failed to deliver success. They, in my humble assessment, most of the ones that I can track down appear to have ideologically more in common with Daesh than they do with secular regimes. And indeed, some of the weapons that are being supplied to them, according to a recent BBC report based on a CRG investigation, show that those weapons are arriving in Iraq, in Mosul, only a matter of days, weeks after they've been delivered to the fighters, to these mythical rebels in Syria. So what needs to be done is for a singularity of aim in Syria, and the West particularly will need to make a choice, which I would expect will at least be addressed, if not made, very soon after the new administration comes into Washington, as to whether they continue with this containment strategy whilst on Daesh, whilst prioritising the regime change in Syria. If that strategy is changed and the Trump administration chooses to make common cause with the Russians on common interest, and that is the elimination or the reduction significantly of extremism in the region, allowing, therefore, scope and space to find a political solution to the Assad regime, then I think we have, in my opinion, some hope of success. Not necessarily next year, almost certainly not next year, but what we can look forward to is some improvement in the years to come, and hopefully a foundation which will conform to military principles of singularity of aim, which are of course based on Clausewitz's maxim of success. You have to have a single aim, clearly identified, clearly maintained, to achieve success. So what are the alternatives? The alternatives in Syria are continuing complexity, continuing instability, and continuing overspill of that conflict, not just regionally, but also, as we've seen in the last year or so, particularly into Europe and beyond, in the form of inspired terrorism, in the form of refugees, in the form of asylum seekers, which are having political and economic consequences in Europe and elsewhere. So I think that to sum up, what will determine the long-term success in this conflict and in the region will be not just those issues that I've talked about, specific issues, but a realization and an acceptance amongst global strategists that the business of regime change by force, and particularly the business of arming civilian proxies, is a policy that is way beyond its sell-by date. It has no effectiveness in the modern world. If you leave aside the ethical and moral and philosophical arguments, it has not delivered success in the last two or three decades. What it has done is cause greater instability, greater problems, and the consequences of failures of these policies, which have been going on for decades, could be maintained, could be limited geographically and in time. They can no longer be limited geographically, and they can no longer be limited in time. So that, I believe, is the fundamental issue from which some of the assessment that I've made and some of the suggestions I've offered follow.
Thank you very much for having me. I suppose what I'll do in my 8 minutes is kind of look a bit more in the focus on Iraq and on the battle for Mosul, because I do think that sometimes putting Raqqa and Mosul together kind of conflates and gives us certain misunderstandings that they are indeed not the same battle, even though you're fighting against the same enemy. In Mosul, you have everyone on the same page to some extent with Islamic State as an external threat. In Syria, it's much more complicated than that. So in Iraq, in Mosul, what you have for the first time in history, really, is the Kurdish Peshmerga, the Kurdistan region's Peshmerga, fighting side by side with the Iraqi army, the Arab Iraqi army. And the coordination has been good. And they've been very successful going in. I'll do a bit on the military very briefly, but I'll do much more on the political dynamics, because fundamentally I believe that it's in the political dynamics that we need to understand in order to ensure that this doesn't continue to happen, because you can continue to bomb and to fight against these type of Salafi jihadi groups, but if you don't locate the dynamics, the political dynamics, they're going to keep coming back, and that's why I think the political side is more important. On the military side, the path towards Mosul, you've had this coordination between the Iraqi forces, which have rebuilt themselves since 2014 when they collapsed, supported by Shia militias under the Popular Mobilization Units, the Hashd al-Shaabi, as well as the Kurdistan Region's Peshmerga, as well as Iran, as well as Turkey, as well as, you know, U.S. advisors. I mean, it's a huge international coalition of fighters all on the same page now. And I'll get back to why it's important to come to a political decision now while they're together, because they're not going to be together once the enemy is removed. And that's why it's very important. I've just come back from Baghdad. I went to Baghdad. I went to Erbil. I wanted to get a sense of, you know, the mood of the people, what's going on, what the political solutions are, because you don't get that from the media and you don't get that from analysis that kind of views it based on the discourse of on Twitter and Facebook. And the mood is quite high. I mean, Iraqis are excited to see what comes next. Most Iraqis are against ISIS, I think it's fair to say. Even those who may have supported the Islamic State in June 2014, when it started to take over big cities, have now been fed up with the type of governance, basically failed governance structures that the Islamic State has provided in Fallujah, in Mosul, and other Iraqi cities. So they're looking for an alternative, and they're open. One of the issues, of course, has been, so far it's been in villages. They've been fighting inside villages, and there hasn't been that many people. Once the armed forces start going into the city, that's where you have urban warfare. And the problem is, many expected that the people of Mosul would flee into camps. They haven't. Many of them have decided to stay in their homes, and they're saying, we don't want to leave. What that means is the battle is even more complicated, because you have, of course, ISIS fighters within the population, with having their headquarters inside hospitals and inside civilian centers. So this is what they're calling a street battle, where blocks could take days to take over, to clear out. So it's going to take a while. And so that's sort of where we're at. So they've managed to clear many of the villages, but they're still on the way to the city where the real battle will take place. And that's not to say that this battle will have a successful ending insofar as the Islamic State will have to leave Mosul. They'll go back to underground. They'll become an insurgency group and try and wait for the political leaders to fail again. And that's sort of my second point. What does success mean politically? Since 2003, Iraqis thought that decentralization was the key, right? However, they had a fundamental misunderstanding of what decentralization actually means. They thought that decentralization, and not just Iraqis, much of the international community, meant a weak central government. So you don't have an emergence of someone like Saddam Hussein. The problem with that is what you had is a central government that's so weak that it's unable to control its cities. It loses power, right? And here's a fundamental distinction, I think, about decentralization is that you need a strong central government that gives power. That gives power to their local components and to the provinces and to the regions. And so now Iraqis are coming back and saying, you know, this is what we need. We can't have a Baghdad that's unable to control its borders. A Baghdad between Syria and Iraq that you know, jihadi fighters go back and forth. They're starting to try and reconceive of what Iraqi governance needs to be. At the same time, another political problem in Iraq is that you've had the same leadership ruling the country since 2003. Much of this leadership, as we know, never lived in Iraq before 2003. They were exiled. And you've had leaders who've gone from being the prime minister to the vice president to the foreign minister. I mean, the same people. And because of that, what you've had is a protest movement that's emerged in Iraq. You see it in Baghdad and in the south, where Shia protesters are protesting against their own Shia leaders. In Kurdistan, you have Kurdish protesters protesting against the Barzani Kurdish leaders. Right? And this is why I think that even in the Sunni areas of Iraq, they haven't had the ability yet or the chance to have political thought. But what's going to happen after the liberation of Mosul is there's going to be a Sunni protest movement as well. And these leaders who, you know, the West is backing, and these leaders who are, you know, like Athil Najafi, Khaled Obeidi, I mean, these leaders who are just expecting to go back to Mosul and pick up where they left off, that they'll have issues claiming legitimacy, because there is a crisis of representation. So we need new leaders, and this is what the protest movement in Iraq signifies, that the people are fed up, they're looking, they're no longer thinking identity politics only. I'm a Shia, I vote for Shia, I'm Sunni, I vote for Sunni, but they're thinking, we need a government that's able to give us electricity, to be able to give us services, and to be able to, you know, provide some form of security. And I think fundamentally that's something positive to take out of this generally a negative conversation that we have, or a pessimistic conversation that we have when we talk about Iraq. However, the last part of my talk will be about this. There are two important elections coming up in Iraq. In 2017, which probably might be delayed until after the liberation, and then 2018, a parliamentary sort of general election. The future of Mosul and the future of what happens in Kurdistan, as well as in the Sunni areas and the Shia areas, will be determined by the Shia of Iraq. They're the power brokers. They're the majority, and they're the most powerful. And so fundamentally, we need to understand who is making decisions in Iraq. And it's a central government. It's in Baghdad. And right now, you have two sort of main actors. You have Nouri al-Maliki, who was the former prime minister, who was supported by people like Joe Biden, people like the UK, even though he lost the 2010 election. Also, of course, supported by Iran heavily. He had to give up power after he lost Mosul. He lost a third of his country, and yet people are kind of betting him to be the strong man who will return. And he's trying to return. And he's trying to use the Shia militias and the legitimacy of the Shia militias as part of his return. If you go to the streets of Baghdad today, all the billboards, all the images you see are different Shia militias. And we're talking 50 or 60 different militias with their martyrs. Everywhere you go, everywhere you drive, you have pictures of martyrs and then a logo of the militia who the martyr died for. Right? So it's almost become impossible to criticize these militias. And to some extent, that's fair. I mean, they have been on the front line fighting ISIS, and these martyrs have died fighting ISIS. What people like Maliki will try and do is politicize this. They'll take the sacrifices and they'll take these militias and say, we need to come back, I've been in charge of this. Against Maliki is a completely opposite character, Muqtada al-Sadr. I'm sure many people in this room know Muqtada al-Sadr as a firebrand cleric, as the head of the Mahdi army, you know, the one who attacked many of the Brits, many Americans. He's trying to rebrand his image. He's taking over this protest movement. He's anti-Iran. He's saying Iran shouldn't interfere. He's saying that Iraq, a lot of his discourse is Iraqi nationalist discourse. And he's even meeting with communists and non-religious politicians as well. He's trying to create a different government, a government that's not supported by Iran and also not supported by any international force. And so these are the two sides that will determine the future of Iraq, the future of state building in Iraq. Because, I'll conclude with this, as I say, representation is the key, not Sunni Shia, not sectarianism. If the Sunnis in Mosul believe that their Sunni leadership, because keep in mind, Sunnis have also been part of the government in Iraq, if they believe that their Sunni leadership is representing them and providing them with the services, we won't have ISIS. The same with the Kurds and the Shia. So we need to look more at the political than the military, and I'll conclude with that, and I look forward to the questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Julius.
Well, my lord, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for the invitation. Of all the people in this room, I'm probably the least specialist in Middle Eastern affairs, but nevertheless, I think I have one or two observations that might be pertinent. When the Arab uprising started, there was a distinct feeling of unease on the part of people who think like me about the use of the terminology Arab Spring, because that suggested that what we were about to see was something analogous to the downfall of communist dictatorship in Central and Eastern Europe, and indeed in Russia itself. And in reality, what we learnt as one conflict succeeded another was that not all countries are at the same stage of political development. And when the original conflict took place, in which we were involved in toppling Saddam Hussein, it was very much presented to us, and I have to admit, I swallowed a lot of it, that if we could just get rid of this terrible dictator, what we would see would be the emergence of something like democracy, or at least progress towards it. As we all know, what we actually saw was the re-emergence of the thousand-year-old hatreds between different branches of fundamentalist Islam. And here, I think, there is some sort of parallel to be drawn between communist oppression and Islamist oppression. And that is the one thing they both have in common, which is totalitarianism. And in one case, the totalitarianism was the totalitarianism of Marxism-Leninism. In the other case, it was the totalitarianism of fundamentalist religion. And my mind goes back to, 600, 700 years ago in this country, when there was a pretty totalitarian fundamentalist religious view of politics abroad then. So much so, in fact, that if you happened to subscribe to the wrong way of worshipping Almighty God, you could find yourself put to death in the name of religion in exceptionally unpleasant, slow, and tortuous ways. And so why is it that I feel that the situation has changed from the zero-sum games of the Cold War? We know and we are alarmed by the fact that Russia is moving towards some form of aggressive nationalist assertiveness. However, they are doing it on the basis of old-style power politics. They do not have the totalitarian, quasi-religious creed of Marxism-Leninism that gave them a ready-made fifth column in the target countries against which they proposed to take aggressive action. By contrast, Islamism is similar to that old formulation that we faced in the dark years of the Cold Wars, because amongst the diaspora of the Muslim communities, the vast majority of whom we hope and believe are wedded to reasonableness and a degree of integration in the societies where they have chosen to build their lives, can be found and can be cultivated and can be subverted, as it were, small numbers of people in the name of totalitarian religion who will undertake terrorist actions. Now, the Defence Select Committee paid a visit to Northern Ireland last week, and it reminded me of the fact of how few people it takes when they've got a bit of wider support in a community to bring a society almost to its knees by terrorist action, and how long it takes conventional military containment to eventually see the problem through and come out the other end of all that horror. And in the case of Northern Ireland, as we know, it was 38 years. Now, of course, there have been examples in the past of overthrown totalitarian societies where huge military effort was put in and democracy did take root a bit sooner. We saw it in Germany, but we had to fight the Second World War to do it. We saw it in Japan, but we had to drop atomic bombs and fight the war in the Far East to do it. And arguably, and the experts here in this room will know better than I, we could say that we're seeing it in Iraq. Because although it has become a commonplace now to say, yes, of course, if we had our time again, we would not remove Saddam Hussein. The fact is we did remove Saddam Hussein. We got what should have been the predictable civil war, which is why we were wrong to make the same mistake in relation to Gaddafi in Libya. But we got that civil war. We got all the terrible bloodletting. We got the huge investment of military and other efforts. And after all this, at the end, yes, maybe there will be some sort of reasonably acceptable political regime to come out of that in the end. But it is a very costly way of implanting something like democracy, and you'd better recognise that if you're going to try and do that, that is the sort of effort, unless you are prepared to wait for the gradual evolution of societies. Why is this relevant particularly to Syria? Well, I think the answer is fairly obvious. We were told by Prime Minister Cameron that there was a third way, that it really was not good enough to say, as people like Afzal Ashraf and I and others say, that in Syria, either the Islamists are going to win or Assad or somebody repressive like him is going to win. And so it was put forward that there are these moderate forces that, if only we support them, are going to transform that society. Now, the Defence Select Committee produced this report. The final text was unanimous, but there were various amendments made along the way which are recorded in the back of the report. Might be worth looking at. It's UK military operations in Syria and Iraq. And it's often forgotten that there was no real dissent when it came to the bombing of Daesh in Iraq when that vote was taken. In, I think, 2014. The real dissent arose on the question of whether we should be bombing first Assad, as was proposed in 2013, and then Daesh, as was proposed in 2015, and as ultimately went through. And as I always observe, it is risky enough to try and intervene on one side in anyone else's civil war, where you want one side to win and the other side to lose, but it is pure madness to intervene when you want both sides to lose. We actually tend to forget that after 9/11, everything hinged on Al-Qaeda. And so if only Al-Qaeda could be got rid of, or even better, one man, Osama bin Laden, would be got rid of, then that would be problem solved. Then, of course, as Al-Qaeda declined and was degraded, ISIL-Daesh came up. ISIL-Daesh is untypical in that by choosing to seize and hold territory, they have given up the one great strength of terrorist and insurgent movements, which is their invisibility. So insofar as one can predict what will happen next, I think it is fairly predictable that ISIL-Daesh will be sooner or later driven out of its territorial gains in these countries. But that will not be the end of the problem, because the root of the problem lies in what is it that is spreading this totalitarian doctrine that encourages people to make enormous sacrifices and to inflict unspeakable brutalities on people. And whereas in the Cold War, and this is my concluding but rather paradoxical point, whereas in the Cold War, it was quite easy to see what was happening. The totalitarian doctrine was being promoted by communist Russia and communist China. And there the source was obvious, because they were the ones who posed overt military threats to us. They were our adversaries, and they were also promoting the totalitarian and subversive doctrine. But the odd thing is, when we look at the totalitarian subversive doctrines of fundamentalist Islam that are spreading around the world and causing problems in our countries where tiny minorities of people do terribly dangerous and lethal terrorist activities, we find that they are being promoted by countries like Saudi Arabia, like Qatar, and increasingly, I fear for the future, like Turkey. And the odd thing is, those people are supposed to be our allies. So we have a strange cross-cutting situation where our traditional adversaries, the Russians, are beginning to get up to their old games again in Central Europe and have to be opposed there, but where arguably, we have some common interests with them, as one earlier speaker suggested, in relation to ISIL, Daesh, and fundamentalist terrorism. I recognize the danger of being manipulated by Russia into doing their will because of a shared common enemy. But sometimes shared common enemies mean that you can actually cooperate with people in one theatre whilst standing up to them in another. And that is what I, though not necessarily all other members of the Defence Select Committee, recommend that we ought to do. Thank you.
Thank you all for having me. For those of you who were here last week, this is my speech is sort of a continuation of that and of the three previous speakers. I'm going to try to kind of wrap things up here. I'm not representing, of course, the U.S. government, current or in the near future. And I'm not going to talk really about what's about to happen in Mosul or Aleppo in the coming weeks, but rather to have a conversation with you about how to think about the Middle East. After 50 years of travel to the region, June 66 to be precise, I still don't have the answers. I'm not here to win any arguments, but I do want to outline right away a few prisms, how to view the Middle East through these different prisms, and then I want to spend a few minutes on the President-elect's possible Middle East policy and try to weave the prism themes together with the Trump themes. The first prism, of course, is democracy. And that was a popular way of looking at the Middle East 5 years ago. If we had this session 5 years ago, we would have been talking about, forgive me for using the term, Arab Spring. I would also say that the humanitarian prism is a subset of democracy. The second prism is the counterterrorism prism. This was prevalent 10 years ago, and it receded when the Arab Street dominated. But now it's ascending big time for the reasons that the previous three speakers have alluded to. And then as ISIS has come on in June 2014, taking over Mosul, the folks in Washington, you could see when they started looking at Syria, you could see that this counterterrorism prism was ascending. And that's when they started to really wonder, well, maybe after Assad won't be so great. Maybe it'll be chaos. Maybe it'll be Al-Qaeda or ISIS filling that vacuum. And finally, the prism that I'm pretty much going to discuss for the rest of this talk is the geopolitical or strategic trends in the Middle East. And obviously the big picture is that there's been a collapse of Sunni Arab governments, not all, but some, a weakening of others. I think Renaud made an excellent point when he talks about the decentralization and the lack of enough power in the center to project security through their borders. There is also, concomitant with the decline of the Sunni Arab world, the rise of the non-Arabs. You have Iran, you have Turkey, you have Israel, and you have the Kurds, who are not yet a state, but I think someday will be a state. So you have a kind of a game of camps going on, a game of thrones, as one author used this. Game of camps to describe ISIS is one camp, ISIS al-Qaeda, if you wish, the Iran-led Shia. And then you have the stability camp, which includes some of the countries that you mentioned, Julian, Saudi Arabia, for instance, the monarchies and a few other moderates, Egypt I would put there, the Palestinian Authority. So let's shift gears here and ask, what will Trump do in the Middle East? Well, let me just say that Trump is the first president of the United States, I think we've had 44 before, who has never had political office and who has never served in the military, one or the other. We've always had a president who's done one or the other. One of the first things I will say, because it's very topical, is that who he picks in his cabinet is very important, and particularly, especially for us, who he picks as Secretary of State is very important. The latest news is that General Petraeus had an excellent meeting with him. Of course, General Petraeus is not a clean bill, as Lord Hannay and I were discussing earlier, and it remains to be seen how much his alleged felony, though he didn't ultimately get charged with a felony, but his breach with the emails with his girlfriend in Kabul, how much that will affect. But I think that Trump is probably, you know, he's looking at the alternatives, and maybe this Bob Corker might be a suitable alternative. But let me tell you, I spent a lot of years in New York when Giuliani was a prosecutor and then when he was a mayor. There's a guy who, when he decided to sue for divorce, he didn't tell his wife. He told the news media first and then told his wife. And this is not a nice man. This is a man who likes vendettas. To have him together with Mr. Trump, who also can go off the rails rather easily, would be, I think, highly toxic. So, of course, Romney would be ideal in the sense of persona, but I don't know what Romney knows about foreign policy. So I kind of like the idea of Petraeus. Anyway, what does Petraeus believe? Well, he kind of sees things from the counterterrorism prism. He spoke at RUSI not long ago about this being a generational war, right? It's going to last a long time. But he also, and this is where I want to leave you in my 8 minutes here, he also believes in the threat and use of military force to coerce adversaries into settling for diplomatic solutions more favorable to the West and the United States' interests. Now, let's look at how the Obama administration views military force. It is a slippery slope to boots on the ground and another multi-trillion-dollar nation-building exercise. But wait a minute. Obama may not have listened to Petraeus, but somebody did. Vladimir Putin and the Iranians. They moved incrementally with force, incrementally. They didn't start a world war. They didn't throw millions of boots on the ground. But they moved in just 14 months ago. Petraeus initially moved in for defensive reasons. Assad's regime was collapsing. They were about to lose Latakia. They were about to lose the Alawi homelands, and the Russians were about to lose that silly little base that they've had for years. Hardly anything, but it became an excuse for Petraeus' doctrine, for Vladimir Putin to fill that vacuum left by this flawed doctrine that you can't use military force to support diplomacy. It's a ludicrous doctrine. And that is the doctrine that will be reversed under Trump. It would have been reversed under Hillary Clinton, in my opinion. But I just think that with yesterday's fall of East Aleppo by the Russians, the Hezbollah, Iran, together with the Syrian regime. I just think that the mood in the new appointees, the new National Security Council advisor, General Flynn, whom I don't know, the new CIA director, Pompeo, whom I don't know. I think, but these guys have seen, since the Bush administration, they launch a war against Saddam for whose benefit? Who won? Iran won. They launched a war against the Taliban. Who won? Iran won. We've gone after Gaddafi, another Sunni dictator. But when it came time to get rid of Assad, who was truly an asset of Iran, no, boots on the ground. So I think that we're heading toward a very difficult period with U.S. and Iran relations, not on the nuclear deal. The Iranians have a lot to gain from there, and they still need to build up their air force. They need their Sukhois, and they need their pilots to be trained properly. So I think they're going to be good for a couple years. But when it comes to their regional aggression, well, let me just say this. The chief of the Iranian army said 2 days ago that Iran is thinking of having sea bases in Syria and Yemen. Now, I hope that the new administration, whoever is the Secretary of State and whoever is the Secretary of Defense, will help the president, because he's not very experienced in this, but he's a pragmatist, to help teach him the word deterrence, which basically means if you do A, B, and C, we will do D, E, and F. Doesn't mean boots on the ground. In fact, if anything, Mr. Trump will try to use other allies in the Middle East to help rather than have U.S. boots on the ground. And the Kurds are a good example, the Syrian Kurds. So that's where I'm at. I think that we're in for some terra incognita. I think we have three prisons with which to look at the Middle East. The democracy prison, which is still important. What the Arab people want is still important. Representative government is key. Counterterrorism is awfully important. Boy, in this city, it will be. And then finally, geostrategic interests, the political interests of the players, understanding how they operate and understanding how they fill vacuums. Thank you very much.